host, Dmitry Filipovich.
Welcome to the Hockey PDO Cast. My name is Dmitry Filipovich, and joining me is my good buddy Thomas Jans. Tom, what's going on, man?
Doing well, buddy. I'm excited for tomorrow. Like this, you know what? I actually kind of like that there's a quiet calm before the storm week in the NHL, because if you think about what's coming for the next 3 weeks, right? It's just going to be hockey games every second day, Stanley Cup awarded, and then, you know, on the later of June 15th or 48 hours after the Cup is awarded, it's going to be like buyouts, NHL awards, draft, free agency, qualifying offer deadline. Like, it's
pictures
not
of cottages.
Well, and then it suddenly comes to an abrupt end when the major insiders tweet the photos from lakes in Ontario.
Yes.
But I mean, this next stretch, starting on Saturday, it's going to be nonstop hockey. And I actually didn't mind having, like, it sucks because I want these games to start and I can't wait for tomorrow. But it's nice to almost have, like, some time for sober reflection ahead of hockey's biggest showcase and then hockey's news apocalypse, which is upon us beginning Saturday.
It is. I do miss the games because I was thinking, right now you and I have a great setup, as people who have listened to us this week know. We're out here in Palm Springs. We're having the time of our lives. We're doing a fantasy football startup dynasty mock draft, or actual draft, not even. I mean, we did a lot of mock drafts before, certainly. We're doing the draft. We're hanging out in the pool. We're enjoying this 40-degree weather. We're drinking some long drinks, which I've heard people say are the second finest Finnish import after Sasha Barkov. We're having a great time. All we're missing is actual meaningful hockey games to watch. We haven't had it for about a week. Our long national nightmare is almost over because we're almost there this Friday. We're going to get it on Saturday. So looking forward to it. Is there any stuff that you think we've kind of left on the table from this series perspective? Because we've had a couple shows here this week sort of previewing it. First, we did the X Factors earlier. Then we did kind of a more macro view of some of the matchups that are going to define the series. I feel like we've covered most of it, or at least done like our fair share on pretty much everything that matters. Do you think we've left any kind of meat on the bone for preview purposes?
I don't know that we have, but we haven't had an opportunity to react to practice lines from Sunrise at Media Day.
Nurse and CC have been reunited.
Yes. And the Oilers are, in fact, going with, you know, a Fogle third line with McLeod and Perry. Derek Ryan, who struggled, of course, against the Stars, pulled out of the lineup. So, look, we debated this a little bit because I was wondering if the Oilers might feel that they need as much speed, maximum speed in their top nine, just to make sure that they can beat the Panthers' pressure game, similar to what they did against the Vancouver Canucks in their second round series. And, you know, they've gone the opposite direction, which was something I think you predicted. Mm. You assumed that they might consider, because they've loaded up on the size of their second pair. They've kept Perry in the top nine. And, you know, they've, with Henrique and McLeod playing on different bottom six lines, they've really fattened their forward line overall. So my reaction to this is I do wonder how much Gaudreau has impacted some of what Knobloch's thinking about. I wonder how much Knobloch thinks that he can get at the Panthers' fourth line in the wake of what we saw in that Rangers series. And I do think he wants to have the size edge, at least as the series opens.
The greatest trick that the Panthers have played on the hockey world over these past 2 years has been sort of getting people to believe this idea that what makes them special is kind of this like toughness and physicality. And certainly there's an element of that, but I think it's sort of a bit of a red herring, because what's happening beneath the surface is like just immense pressure and relentless pace and like undeniable skill as well. And so watching them play, I feel like it's easy, especially for an NHL coach, to sort of talk themselves into like, oh, we need to be able to match this physicality they're going to bring to the table.
Chuck and Bennett going to be buzzing around.
It's like, oh, we need to have an answer for that. Yeah. But the reality is that, I mean, in an ideal world, you would, but you can't kind of overcompensate for it and sort of diminish yourself or shoot yourself in the foot elsewhere. And I feel like that's what some of these decisions are shaping up to be. I think the good news is it's going to be a long series, I think we both believe. And it might be as simple as like just game one to sort of quote-unquote set the tone, and then you'll quickly realize that what the demands of the series are going to entail is going to force you to actually do the right thing and field your best lineup.
Yeah, and I mean, the one other mitigating thing is you put Henrique with Fogle and McLeod. Like, it's one tweak to your forward line, and it's Broberg goes back to playing with with CeCe, and Kulak moves back up to the right side, and boom, you're right back to, you know, something closer to a lineup that allows you to approximate what I think we think they're going to need, which is, you know, to recognize that the Panthers are more likely to skate you off the ice than push you off of it.
Yes.
And that's your major threat.
While we're on this topic, I've got a mailbag question from a listener that kind of relates to this, and I think it's a good entryway for us because I think I want to take some mailbag questions today as well, since I think we have a bit of time at the end of the show. But Carmen asks, assuming we see Paul Maurice choose to use the Tkachuk line versus the Draisaitl line when possible, and given Tkachuk's strengths, playmaking from behind the net and along the wall, what's the best option for Edmonton from a defense pair perspective?
Oof.
Now, the reason why this is interesting is yesterday we spoke so much about how we're expecting a heavy dose of Barkov in Florida's top pair against McDavid and Edmonton's top pair, right? And because those guys all kind of played together for the most part in our five-man units, that's going to leave a situation where if we do get this second line versus second line, Florida's going to have Brandon Montour and Nico Mikkola out there, whereas Edmonton now might have Darnell Nurse and Cody Ceci, but regardless, we'll have one of those guys out there. And I think that's a very exploitable matchup from Florida's perspective,
yes,
because that Tkachuk line, as the listener astutely pointed out, works so much from like behind the net and sort of moves the puck around the offensive zone. And I think that's where those defensemen struggle, because all of a sudden they don't know where to go. They kind of get caught chasing. And then they forecheck so well as well. And neither of those guys, especially, I think that's why they don't work together. Like, they just cannot move the puck. And so they just wind up punting it off the boards and out. And we've talked about how Florida's just going to knock that down and bring it right back in. And so I don't – it might last one game. It might not. This might just be kind of like a – oh yeah, we're gonna do this, but when the game starts, they won't actually, or they'll quickly, like, common sense will prevail. But I just, they cannot get away with it in the series.
You know, it's interesting. I don't mean to squirrel your sort of statement, but the idea that they can't move the puck is sort of interesting to me, because I actually think they're both kind of interesting through the neutral zone. It's just the
blue line is a barrier for them, and they like cannot pass it with the puck, but then as soon as they get past it, I'm with you that they're useful,
they're
as the third man in the rush and stuff like
it's,
that.
It's almost like they can support a puck carrier,
right?
You know what I mean? But neither of them's a primary, and it's almost like they both get caught leaning on occasion, because they are, I think, both inclined, and I actually think it's one of their best traits, that I think they're both inclined to try and be aggressive in supporting the breakout. They just can't lead it from the back end.
Right.
And so it's like a, it's almost a mix that I think diminishes them both beyond what's necessarily true about them individually. But, you know, I hadn't thought a ton about that soft underbelly that the Panthers can pick at, and now that I have, first of all, I bet that's the primary motivation in Nurse and CeCe being reunited, is
right,
that those are, you know, the two guys behind Bouchard and Ekholm that that Knobloch trusts most, and that sort of poses some really interesting tactical questions for the rest of the series. Like, can they continue to play Bouchard and McDavid as a five-man unit?
Mm.
At some point, do they have to consider evening it out to contest Florida's loaded second line? Are there, you know, how much can the Tkachuk line, especially if they have success early in the series, get the Oilers out of some of what's powered them here? And, you know, is it really that the Oilers just have to put up enough margin at the top of the lineup to offset what, like, is the goal for McDavid ultimately to outscore whatever damage the Florida second line is able to do against the Oilers? That might be one of the central dynamics of the series. So what's their best option? I think it's Nurse Kulak.
Yes.
But I don't say that with a ton of confidence.
Yeah, I don't think they can play Nurse and CeCe together, because they get so easily pressured into like mistakes and,
mm-hmm,
and lack of situational awareness with and without the puck. And that's just so exploitable when both guys are out there at the same time. Like, one of them is just always messing up seemingly. And that's why you need Kulak out there, because he's just so solid and reliable and pretty much the opposite of them in that way.
What do you think about the playing a lefty on the right side aspect given Florida's pressure game? Do you think that's something Knobloch's worried about? Like, moving Kulak back to his natural left side and putting Broberg there, and getting a lefty out of your top four, is there something there too where it's like, I'm worried about Florida's pressure game, the way that they're going to try and overload you know, the points when the puck, like defensively, like challenge at the point, and we don't want to give up rush chances as a result of Brett Kulak against Matthew Tkachuk trying to take the puck on his backhand off the wall.
Yeah, I certainly think there's something to that. We spoke a lot about how that, like, Lindell Lustarinen combination, it's going to be like imperative for them to score in this series for Florida, because that's where they could kind of yield an advantage. The more I think about it, I really think like Matthew Tkachuk needs to have a monster series here because of what we're just saying, where he's just going to get these assignments that I think are more exploitable for him, but can also then sort of limit Leon Draisaitl if you're just forcing him to expend energy chasing in the defensive zone. And you look at the series he had against New York, he wasn't necessarily scoring much, but the Panthers had 66% of the shots, 70% of the high danger chances with him on the ice. And I was thinking about this. I think you'll like this analogy. The role he kind of plays as a bit of a, like a midfield anchor there from a soccer perspective, is very interesting in this series, because something that Dallas really struggled with in the West final against Edmonton was every time they would either sort of lob the puck into the neutral zone or try to get one of these longer plays, it would immediately get nullified by a Zach Hyman, by a Ryan Nugent-Hopkins, by a Draisaitl or McDavid, where they would just be sort of winning these neutral zone battles. And Tkachuk is one of the best players in the world at turning his back to the defender, sort of settling a wild puck, and then putting it on a silver platter for one of his teammates to then attack downhill or do something creatively. And so that's just something Dallas didn't really have as an option for them, and that was a limiting factor for them offensively. And so that's why I keep coming back to, like, if Tkachuk's able to win those neutral zone battles and kind of get them going in the right direction, it's going to answer a lot of the questions we have heading into the series.
Yeah. I think it's a fantastic mailbag submission, because in some ways it reframes the question almost in a more interesting way that I think hits at perhaps the fundamental dynamic of the series, which is, can the Oilers' top five outscore everything else? And we kind of knew that. But the Tkachuk angle, the idea that the Panthers have their own offensive engine that can do similar damage, especially given that the Oilers probably can't hunt, like, the Oilers can't hunt minutes McDavid against Tkachuk, or the McDavid-led five-man unit against Tkachuk, because you don't want Barkov doing the same either. And so, yeah, I mean, that's going to be a fascinating thing to watch, and I think hits at, you know, what's really been the question of this entire Oilers playoff run, and one that they've been able to answer pretty definitively to this point.
Well, if you take something from these shows, I think the main battleground for this series, obviously the special teams is going to play an outsized role, but can Edmonton have some sort of a viable plan for getting out of their zone against this Panthers forecheck? And then can they establish and maintain offensive zone possession time? Because the Panthers just never let you do that. And if they're the one team that can actually sort of flex that muscle and get that job done, I think that actually gives them a legitimate chance in the series at 5-on-5, right? And that's where I come back to what we talked about with that five-man unit, and I think the value of Bouchard in particular here. And that's sort of been this kind of like elusive thing, right? Because like the points are through the roof. The underlying numbers are off the charts. I think anyone that's following this stuff is like aware of how good he's been this postseason. Yet we keep coming back to this conversation about, in the grand scheme of NHL defenders, how good is he actually, because he's in this such favorable environment playing on the power play with these guys and playing with McDavid 5-on-5. But then you watch these games, and I think you'll see it in this series, if Edmonton is going to succeed, it's going to be because of his ability to enable everything Edmonton does better than anyone, right? His ability to quick up the puck to McDavid so that he doesn't have to do all the heavy lifting himself. How he pinches in the offensive zone to like keep pucks alive and keep these offensive zone possessions. He just needs to play at his very best. And if that's the case, I actually do think Edmonton can control with those guys out there, even if it is against Barkov and Forsling.
Yeah. So how would you answer? Like, I was saying prior to the playoff stuff, like I rated Bouchard as a top 15 NHL defenseman. I you know, and I think he's having a top five NHL season. Has his performance over the course of this playoffs in any way amended your view of sort of where he sits in that most lofty hierarchy? Because I probably would be willing to upgrade him to, like, comfortably top 10.
Yeah. I mean, that's a really good question. I think certainly based on performance all season, but this postseason in particular, I struggle with, like, him being knocked for the situation he's in, because it doesn't ultimately matter in terms of it's not like we're having a conversation about, all right, well, if Edmonton trades him, what can they get for him? And then what would he look like in this new spot? Like, he's just going to be playing in this spot for however many more years. And well, also, so his ability to succeed in it is all that really matters.
But we do downgrade Makar.
For playing with McKinnon so much?
This season, right. The way that they played together and the fact that Makar didn't eat at quite the same, like with quite the same appetite that he usually does in those the minutes away from McKinnon, I think did probably cost him Norris votes, right? Like, I do think that's a big reason why he won't win the Norris despite gaudy counting stats and doing four or five or 15 things over the course of the year that, like, we never see defensemen right. do that, like, took our breath away. So I don't think it's like an unfair thing in that at least it applies to the guy we all, you know, give the belt to as the best defenseman on the planet. Right. right? Like we're using that context on yeah. Makar too.
Right.
I think that for me anyway, there's not a lot of defensemen that make an environment in the NHL. Like they contribute.
Yes.
But in terms of, you know, changing the environment on the ice, you know, I think a lot of that is usually the realm of the elite forwards, your Barkov, Matthews, McKinnon, McDavid guys.
Yep.
But there's something to be said for being perfectly calibrated to be able to make that environment sharper, like a sharper weapon for your team. And I don't think there's many defensemen on the planet that could take what McDavid does and turn it into as many goals, as many points, and as much control as Bouchard does.
Yep.
And to me, there's massive value in being an amplifier to that extent. Like, you know, he's like a subwoofer.
Yeah.
You know, he's not Bose speakers, Bluetooth speakers. He's like, you know, an industrial, like you can play it in a field and host a festy.
Yeah.
That's the sort of amplifier that Bouchard is. I'll take that. I'll take one of the biggest speakers in the league, especially if I've already got an environment setter like McDavid.
Well, and the value of that particular skill set is also, I'd argue, exactly what you need in this specific series.
Yes.
Because of all these kind of traits that we just described. I also think, like, you will get the occasional odd man rush because Florida's so aggressive, like forechecking and sending so many guys, their defensemen pinch so hard that you will be able to, if you get the puck past them, actually create some 2-on-1s, 3-on-2s, even breakaways. Like, we were seeing, like, Braden Schneider have a breakaway early in the series for New York in these finals. So they're going to get those opportunities. And Bouchard's also so good at, like, instinctually sensing, like, when the lane is there to join on that rush. Mm-hmm. Like, we saw the 2-on-1 goal, right, against the Stars where McDavid shoots it off the pad and Bouchard's able to get the rebound. His ability to sort of, like, sense that and then get involved is huge. And I think they're going to need exactly all those things. And yeah, it's like a great spot for him to be in, but I totally think that he's like either enabling or like allowing them to essentially just play the exact type of way that they have been, which is so successful.
There's also like a rift almost in that, or, you know, there's like a level of trust between the two that I think matters, right? Like, I think if McDavid, low, slow, and available, gets the puck high in the defensive zone and turns up ice, and another defenseman skates as aggressively toward the blue line with absolute pace as Bouchard, just completely abandoning the defensive zone because there's so much faith that McDavid is going to be able to make a play, and now he's another outlet for McDavid. You know, like, how much value is there in the fact that McDavid's always going to be happy to have Bouchard doing that? Whereas if Brett Kulak did it or Philip Roberg, it's the meme where it's, you know, the person coming to the cubicle, right? And it's like, oh, you know, like, that's harassment, right?
Yeah.
Like, Bouchard doing it, great.
Yes.
Broberg doing it, like, hey, buddy.
Yeah.
You know, stay back there. Chill. How much value is there in that rift, in that level of trust?
For sure.
Almost like, you know, QB and his favorite slot receiver,
right?
Like, there's something there. And you know, we all, again, in that situation, you debate who's greater, the receiver or the quarterback, but you also know that there's chemistry. And I do think in an effort to do what's hardest, right, which is parcel out who deserves individual credit within a free-flowing team game like hockey, I do think we sometimes underrate the amplification thing.
Right.
Like, I think we did it with Chris Kunitz a decade ago. Mm. I think we did it with Alex Burrows 15 years ago. I think we did it with Zach Hyman when he first signed in Edmonton.
Yeah.
I think it's happening right now, a conversation in the market that I work in with Philip Peronic and Quinn Hughes. And we know that, you know, Chris Kunitz isn't a superstar, but there's immense value in being a guy at such a level that he, like, upgrades the defensive effectiveness and can still eat playing with your superstar. For me, Bouchard, you know, I think the context of, you know, Bouchard's not like a play driver from the back end. It's like, great. Who is? Like, there's like two of them on the whole planet. The fact that he's the guy who makes those McDavid minutes and like takes them and makes them elevated. I think that's immense and alone puts him among the best defensemen on the planet.
I think he is a play driver though. Like, obviously I think if you stripped him and put him in like, I don't know, name whatever team you want, and he was just playing with like third liners all the time, I'm sure the results would look different. I think that's the case for pretty much like every player in the world though. I like some of the stuff he does in particular, like you'll see, and this is where Edmonton can just feel so impossible to play against, is like they have a good shift in the offensive zone and then you finally get the puck out, especially in the second period with a long change, and you're like, ah, we have a moment to breathe. And the puck gets to like the other blue line, and Bouchard's so good at like quickly getting to it and almost like spinning around, and because of that level of trust, knowing where McDavid is without even like really like stopping to take stock of it, and he just whips it back to him, and then all of a sudden you're just getting another rush from the Oilers, and that's devastating. That's what the Avs were like at their best with MacKinnon and Makar, right? That ability to regroup quickly and just layer multiple rush attacks, and so he does that. And I think McDavid, I'm sure, is very appreciative of the fact that how much easier his life is playing with a player like that, as opposed to all those times where you're playing with inferior defensemen and you go in the neutral zone and you're like, all right, I'm open for a rush. And then the defenseman like just goes off the glass and out and then turns it over, or just turns it over up the middle, and you just never get to see the puck, right? Like, he's getting so many additional opportunities to do what he does better than anyone because of what Bouchard's able to do. And so I think all of that stuff matters.
Yeah, 100%. I probably put it too harshly. I just mean that, you know, I think he's a play driver, but yes. I think his results in non-McDavid minutes would be closer to like, you know, 55% as opposed to like 69. You know, like nice.
Nice.
Like we never see stuff like this, right?
Yes.
Like what you're seeing, I think, is a product of McDavid's excellence married to a guy perfectly suited. So let me put you on an unfair spot. I know we're going to go to break shortly, but let me put you unfairly on the spot and just ask you this question. If the New York Rangers and the Edmonton Oilers straight up traded Adam Fox for Evan Bouchard, who is better? Who got better in that trade?
Who got better in that trade? Man.
It's probably neither.
It's probably neither. I'm sure Adam Fox would enjoy his time more. yeah, I don't know. Both guys are awesome. That's why I know. Why it's such fodder for people to be like, actually, this guy is the 7th best defenseman. And people are like, no, he's the 14th best. And I'm like, I don't know. They're all really good.
Well, like, you know, I think, for example, that Quinn Hughes' ability to drive play as like the engine is pretty unique. Like, I don't think any of the other elite defensemen are tasked with that the same way. But I wouldn't say like Edmonton gets better necessarily getting Hughes for Bouchard because losing the right-handed shot, like all of the attributes that make Bouchard so perfect to add to what McDavid does are different than what Hughes does, and that matters too. So it's like, you know, it's a tricky one to answer, and more than anything, all of these guys are so sick. And
well,
it's just
I think the beauty of that, and probably to your point on that, is like part of what makes Quinn Hughes such a system individually, like regardless of what's around him, is because of how he's able to be puck dominant and like do it all himself, right? Like he'll certainly distribute in the offensive zone and set up others, but just getting you there, he'll take on the task of like, I'm just going to go back, spin around a couple times, make a few people miss, and we're going to go zone to zone seamlessly. Bouchard's much more of a quick distributor, and that works with McDavid because he can just quickly get him the puck across three zones. I'm sure Quinn Hughes would adjust and defer a bit more in that spot. Like all these great players are able to acclimate themselves to their environment, especially when you're like, when you get like encountered with like a force of personality or a force of skill set like McDavid, it's like you kind of mold yourself around that as opposed to being like, actually, I think we should play my game. And I think Connor should adjust to what I'm doing.
Yeah. It's not like what you see in basketball when two superstars join another team and it's like your turn, my turn.
Yeah.
It's like,
it's always Connor McDavid's turn. Yeah. And it should be. All right, let's take our break here before we jump into other mailbag questions and other topics here. And then we're going to do all that. When we come back, you're listening to the Hockey PDOcast streaming on the Sportsnet Radio Network. All right, we're back here in the Hockey PDOcast with Thomas Drance. We are having some fun here on a Friday here on the show. We've done all our previews for the Stanley Cup Final. Now we can just enjoy the show. I know you're saying off the top that you're kind of enjoying this little reprieve here to sort of take stock of where we're at and enjoy the calm before the storm. I just cannot wait for these games to start. And I was thinking about it, like, it's almost the perfect setup here, right? Because it's such an even series. Dom has it about 50-50. The betting line is very close. It's pretty much almost entirely home ice related, I think, in Florida's favor slightly. Since the Christmas break, these two teams were second and third in point percentage and goal differential. Like, they're so, I guess, qualified and, like, worthy representatives of their conferences in this final and of this stage. God, we're going to have Ray Ferraro on the call for the ESPN broadcast. I mean, stylistically, all the things we've talked about in terms of the matchup are going to make for such great theater. This is just going to be an awesome series. So I can't wait for it. I'm so excited. And we should note, you and I will be doing, for games 1 and 3, or 1, 2, and 3, we're going to be doing the show kind of right after the games. It won't be necessarily live, but as soon as the games end, we're going to do like a recap episode, and we're going to try to get it on the feed night of, so that if you finish watching the game and you're like, oh man, I need a breakdown of what just happened, or I just want to hear people talking about it a bit more, and the TV broadcast isn't necessarily doing it for you, you can go on the PDOcast feed, and we're going to have new episodes for you those nights. So looking forward to that. All right, let's take a few more mailbag questions here from the PDOcast Discord. If you want to get involved in that in future editions, pop into the Discord. Invite link is in the show notes. Jacob asks, why does RNH seemingly never make any mistakes? What does he do to make him so effective? You and I talked about this a little bit.
Yeah.
It's a tricky thing. Like, I think it'll be easier if we had a bunch of clips and this was like a TV show, and then you and I could just like play that and be like, now you can sort of see it. It's a more difficult thing to describe because it's obviously not as like physically dominant as maybe some of the other players that are so effective, especially in this series. But I think the genesis of it is he's just always in the right place, right? I think yesterday you were kind of bringing up the Patrice Bergeron example in relation to Barkov always being on the right side of the puck. Mm-hmm. Even though RNH is sort of playing the wing in this constitution on McDavid's line, he's still a natural center. And I think his understanding of that positionally means that you see when he's backtracking on a lot of these plays, he's always in the middle lane and he's always timed it perfectly so that he can cut off whatever pass you're trying to create if you're trying to switch sides in the neutral zone, right? And so there's so many times he's able to like stop that and then bring it right back, and they're able to attack again with McDavid. And that's why I think he's such a good compliment with him.
Yes.
And why he's such a great complimentary player for regardless of who he's playing with, because he's just going to do everything to help get you the puck again. And put that in combination with his power play skill set and his scoring around the net and his ability to distribute as well. I mean, he's just like a phenomenal player. So it's not necessarily one specific thing he does, but I think it's the combination of those things that make him so effective.
So, you know how we like to talk, this is one of my favorite things to talk about. I don't know if you share my enthusiasm for it, but one of my favorite player types across the league is failed first round draft pick.
Right.
Right. Who, you know, usually has to change teams, and then you redesign your game, and then you become an elite checker, and you find yourself in a sixth spot on a third line that's deep in the playoffs, and everyone starts talking about you again.
Yeah.
You know, the Benoit Pouliot, the Andrew Cogliano of it all.
Yes.
Right? One of my favorite player types. One of my favorite guys to see teams gamble on is the guy who had to redesign their game. Now, usually, it's like guy who couldn't make it in the top six and actually like fell out of the league and had to become a different type of defensive player. Like, it's a totally different level of it.
Yes.
Whereas Ryan Nugent-Hopkins was like the next one, right? First overall, one of the most talented WHL players we'd ever seen to that point, comes into the league, has immediate success. Like, he's a 52-point over 62-game guy as a rookie.
Mm.
You know, has that big hat trick early on in his career against a very good Vancouver Canucks team at the time, like a President's Trophy winning team. Made an instant splash and, you know, chugged along as like a 60-point guy for, you know, like his age 18 through 22 season. That's unbelievable. And then as the Oilers' decade of darkness extended, I think it became clear that he was perhaps not an elite 1C.
Mm.
But he never failed in the league. He was still like an excellent, from the age of 18 on, top six caliber forward. So it's almost like the highest possible level of this effect, where it's like, you know, by his fourth season, he's still in his early 20s, but now he's experienced and McDavid joins his team.
Right.
And over the course of the ensuing decade, it's like, while still playing in the league and being productive, he's redesigned his game to be whatever his team needs to play winning hockey. And now he's this jack-of-all-trades player who's more likely to have a highlight for a back check than for, something stunning he did as a playmaker.
Yeah.
And that's, like, how do you even qualify how important that is to just be, like, the perfect player to stick it all together on the power play?
Yeah.
Right? Like, just, like, the quiet behind-the-scenes guy who makes everything better. That's what he's become. And he's partly become it because I think he's figured out how to use the elite skills that made him the first overall pick in sort of the service of the little things in a way we just, like, I can't even think of another guy who's had a similar career arc.
Mm.
You know what I mean? Like, usually these guys,
especially, yeah, staying on the same team for that long.
Staying on the same team for that long and being joined by elite talent like McDavid, that the sort of player that's so alpha that there'd never be a disagreement between you, right? Like that you'd just like work to try and make them successful just naturally because of who they are. I mean, it's almost like an incredible happenstance that has served to create something like the Oilers version of Draymond Green or something, just like the guy in the trenches doing all the stuff that makes that elevates your stars. Incredible. Like, he's just such an incredible player to watch for, like, the elite skill and service of winning in the most nuanced possible phases of the game. It rocks.
No, it really does. And he's perfect playing with McDavid. And also, it's like, both him and Hyman do all of the little stuff that it requires to blend in with a puck dominant superstar while also just being so immensely skilled as
on their own.
Like, and that's the thing that I struggle with, because I don't want to describe RNH as a role player at this point because of that, but that almost feels like it's diminishing how good he actually is, right? Because this isn't like some sort of journeyman that is like in the right spot. Like, he's doing so many just like awesome things, but he's doing it in this very specific role for them. And so he's really fun to watch. Like, watching him off the puck is really good, because he's just so smart. And I know this is like a Belfry thing as well. He loves when natural centers play on the wing and then can sometimes let their, like, the person who's occupying the center role kind of play more wing in terms of just getting out of the middle lane and kind of attacking other ice. And also you want McDavid being able to skate wherever his heart desires, or wherever there's an opening, or wherever he feels like he can attack without worrying about, all right, I need to be back in the middle lane here and always be staying above the puck. And he can do so knowing with full confidence that RNH will just do that for him, right? And so, he's really, really good. Okay. What other questions do we have here? Okay, here's a good one from Pixies. How did Paul Maurice completely flip his narrative in the last 2 years? Well, success. Winning does a lot.
Hear his line today, though?
Do you think he's workshopping? Like, do you think he's like sitting at home in front of the mirror, like brushing his teeth, and then he's like writing down bangers?
I think he's genuinely that funny.
Yeah.
I just think when you're quick like that, you know what I mean? You're just quick like that.
Right.
It doesn't work. If you have to sit at home and come up with your one-liners, they would all fall flat. You know what I mean?
Yeah, he's like looking at notes, but like before answering.
You've either got it or you don't, man. And Paul Maurice has got it. But the line today, did you see that one?
No, what did he say?
He was asked about taking over a 122-point team, and he's like, and I got them down to 92 in my first season. Like, brilliance. So good.
Yeah. I think the answer is pretty simple there. They won a lot, and I think he's also... Listen, like, I was very critical of him towards the end of his time running the Jets, right? And I think there was a lot of stuff to nitpick and be like, oh, I feel like his reluctance to trust young players, like the way they're choosing to play at times, it's suboptimal. And so when he replaced Andrew Burnett in particular after that season, I, like many others, I think, was like, oh man, I don't know if that's the right call. It feels like they're going to take a bit of a step back here. And I guess they did that season from like a points perspective, during the regular season at least. But what he's done this season in particular with them, I think, deserves much more credit than it got, right? I think because they made the Stanley Cup final last year, and because they have such big name players, right? Barkov, Tkachuk, Bobrovsky in net, Ekblad even, in terms of like league-wide recognition and name brand value, even if it's for some of those players may not be fully deserved at this point, a lot of the credit's gone towards them for their success. And all year, even though they started without Montour and Ekblad for whatever, first 10, 15, 20 games, I forget how long it was, after their offseason surgeries, they were still from day one either first or second in every single defensive metric. And it wasn't because they were like just trying to like kill clock and play very conservatively. It was the exact opposite. They were playing so aggressive by design, and it was working to suppress stuff on the other end of the ice. And so I think what he did in terms of encouraging this aggressiveness, and also similarly not having any drop off as well, like how easy do you think it would be for a team to just take a big step back from like a motivation perspective this year after making a long run last year, having all these injuries in the offseason, and then coming back this year, for them to be like, you know what, we had a good year last year, but we're not going to play as hard as we did because it's really tough to sustain. And it felt like all season, even in February, on a Tuesday night of a back-to-back like against Columbus, you were still getting their absolute A game. Even if it didn't result in a win, you knew it wasn't going to be because of a lack of effort. And I give credit to that, to the coach, much like I do with Rod Brind'Amour in Carolina.
Well, and sometimes you have to use what is available to you as opposed to what's optimal. I think coaches will tell you that. And I actually wonder if the level of injury that they dealt with coming into the season helped.
Mm.
You know, and it takes a good coach to convince everybody that, hey, this is like... But
that's a blessing in disguise.
Yeah, but you come in October and November and you don't have a right-handed defenseman in your lineup, period, because both Montour and Ekblad are out for 6 weeks, and then you're having success and it's like, okay, but we can't slip.
Right.
You know, there's an element to which that success feels surprising, or at least to the level that it was, and that almost creates its own momentum, right? Mm. That like we will win if we play like this even without those guys. Now imagine what we'll do when we get them. Let's show ourselves. You know, like it's almost like the challenges redouble upon themselves to sort of drive it forward, as it were. And so, you know, I think the fact that the Panthers went into this offseason and had to effectively take a zero RD approach to their team building, you know, I actually think that might be one of the things that amplified it. Because certainly, like, I can tell you, among Panthers forwards and stuff, like, the lack of a right-handed defenseman was, like, something they were thinking about a lot early in the year.
Yeah. No, I think the job they did there was, regardless of what you attributed to, was phenomenal. Yeah. And I think it's interesting as well, right? Like, I think a guy you cover closely, Rick Tocchet, is going to have to figure this out as well, because I just think it's really tough when you so much of your game... And listen, the Panthers are so deep and so talented, so it's not like they have to do this, but it's very difficult to channel that type of effort for this long of a period of time.
No kidding.
And without having like slip up, without having people sort of like start resenting others, or like being like, listen, like I'm not going to take this from you anymore and ask for a trade or just stop playing the way they have. And there's been really none of that. And everyone just seems incredibly happy. I guess it's a chicken or the egg thing. How much of it is winning? How much are you winning? Are you winning because of it? And how much of it is happening because you're winning? I'm sure it's kind of intertwined, but yeah, I mean, this is quite a run they're on, and he certainly, like, in my mind, rehabilitated his image as a coach quite significantly, to the point where I was like very high on this year. And go back 3-4 years ago, I loved making a good Paul Maurice joke in Winnipeg. Like, I just think he was not doing a good job, and then now all of a sudden he's doing a phenomenal job. So credit to him. Coaches sometimes get better.
Totally. And well, and especially when you see the writing on the wall, you know, stepping away, thinking about why you had to step away, thinking about what worked and what didn't. But he also had some sick Jets teams.
Yeah, I mean, the one when they lost to Vegas was incredible.
That team should have won the Stanley Cup.
Yeah.
Like, I honestly think if they hadn't had to play the second best team in the league that year.
Series against Nashville was
that, and to me, still like, pinnacle hockey from an aesthetic point of view. Like, when I think about what I love about hockey, that series is like top five for me in my entire lifetime. Like, it was just such good hockey. Those teams were so good. It was clearly the best and the second best team in the league that season, duking it out. I just think the Jets had nothing left when they got through. So I think there have always been flashes for Maurice. I think he has an ability to elevate teams. I think he wants to play fast hockey. I think he wants to play aesthetically pleasing hockey. I don't think he'll necessarily play like that when he doesn't have the personnel.
Mm.
But I think given the personnel that he, you know, inherited in Florida, I think he just completely understood the assignment. So I would say I think we got a little too low on Paul Maurice because I think Paul Maurice is pretty realistic. I think Paul Maurice will adapt to what he's got. And I think he was handed the keys to something really impressive with the Panthers. And he got a little bit of luck, right? They very easily could have missed the playoffs that first season.
Yep.
And maybe he never even gets a shot to do what he did
to
in
the deliver
playoffs.
All these one-liners.
Well, and to do what he did in the playoffs, like if you we talk a lot about the who was it, Buddy Robinson,
Brian Robinson.
Was it really Brian Robinson?
No, Buddy Robinson. Oh, sorry, sorry. I've got fantasy football brain. Yeah,
Buddy Robinson,
big hat, Buddy Robinson.
Well, and like I literally had to check only because I jokingly refer to
you
Brian
keep
Robinson
calling
as
Brian
Buddy
Robinson,
Robinson,
Buddy. Yeah,
yeah. The Buddy Robinson.
The Buddy Robinson butterfly effect?
Well, just yeah. What a fork in the road for Maurice. Like, yes. is he even still the coach in Florida if Chicago doesn't beat the Penguins? You know, like, I think that's an absolutely fair thing to wonder about. And yet, I do think he got enough rope for his quality to show through. But fundamentally, I think he's a really good coach, and I think he always has been. I just think if you give, he's the coach you definitely want, I think, when you have the talent for it.
Right.
And I don't know if he's the coach you necessarily want when you're trying to like eke out wins.
Yes. Or like a rebuilding team or like a team on the way up.
Or even a team like a team that has to devise like a narrow tactical path to winning. Like I don't know that you want Paul Maurice doing that. But I think if you give him a loaded roster, I think he'll have them play like as an up-tempo style of aggressive hockey that's both detailed and allows their quality to show through. And I love that.
Adili asks, is it redundant to assess players in the playoffs when they're likely carrying an injury? I just think people sometimes get carried away with comparing players and how they're performing when we aren't aware of what they're dealing with. I think that's fair.
Very fair.
I think that's fair because I think...
Sign me up for that.
But here's the thing, though. I think why I'm so excited about this Stanley Cup final is that it does feel like both teams are entering at about as fully formed good health as you're going to get.
Yeah.
Right?
I would not assume that, though, with Edmonton's biggest stars.
That's fair. But, I mean, the performance certainly has not slowed down.
Yeah. I'm just telling you, I think after the season, we're going to find out some things about what McDavid and Draisaitl have played through here that are going to up our respect quotient for both.
Right. That's fair. But, I mean, like they're not like Matthew Tkachuk last year where he got hurt and then it's like he cannot play because his body got broken. And so you're like, oh, man, that's tough. I'm with you. I mean, in general, we probably put too much stock in the playoffs, right? Because I think one good postseason run, everyone is aware of this phenomenon of like getting a payday off of it and the timing that out correctly. At the same time, though, this is like the final exam, right? Like the playoffs are what you strive towards. The entire regular season is essentially preparing for it. And so with the quality of competition you're generally facing the further you go into the playoffs, I do think it is very interesting to see how players stack up against each other and whether their game works or doesn't, because it's just a different animal than the regular season is. And so I don't think we can necessarily just like throw it all out and be like, well, this is like a totally unrelated product. I do think there's stuff that we can learn from it, certainly in terms of what applies to future seasons, but we probably do from an individual perspective knock players too much or kind of sour on players who are underperforming. And then even if it doesn't come out that they had some sort of like, you know, ruptured organ or something, they still like were clearly hampered. And maybe that manifested itself in like subtle ways, but important ones nonetheless. So I do think we have to be kind of like careful about how we're evaluating players who like are having off postseasons or tough series. But sometimes it's as simple as just not performing as well. And we can maybe give them too much leeway. So I don't know. I don't know what the answer is, but I think it's an interesting thing.
Yeah, I also think we need to... I also think we need to account for the extent to which, you know, the samples are so small that we're just going to make mistakes evaluating players in the playoffs. You know, that's like the long and the short of it. I just think you don't want to throw it out because it matters and it's actually like the most important time of the year.
Yes.
Matters maybe more than anything else. But so you have to weight it. But I think figuring out exactly how much weight to give it is one of the toughest things in hockey, which is why we see more mistakes getting made, you know, off of this time of year, like off of what happens at this time of year, than we see almost anywhere else except for U18 performance and draft stock.
Yeah, World Juniors.
Yeah, World Juniors and U18s, but U18s even more so in my mind.
Puna Sweet asks, are we doing our due diligence in driving the Gus Forsling for Conn Smythe case?
No, I don't think we
are. I think I personally am. I don't know. I think you need to step your game up a little bit, Tom. I don't think you've been doing nearly enough. But I think I've been doing not only my share, but the share of a lot of other people.
You've been going hard?
I've been going really hard. I just put out a full mixtape of what Gus Forsling did to the New York Rangers, and it was phenomenal. And he's been doing this all postseason. Now, we'll see what happens in this series. As we talked about, there's going to be a lot of minutes against McDavid, and he makes amazing players look silly all the time. And so regardless of what happens, I don't think it should take away from what he did in the first three rounds. Obviously, the Panthers will need to win this series for it to even be a Conn Smythe consideration, because he's not going to win on the losing team. But yeah, I'm excited to see that matchup. All right, one final one here. CL Garrett asks, can you win the cup in the modern NHL with the majority of your core in their 30s? I mean, probably not.
I don't think so.
Right?
I mean, the majority of your core is going to be too expensive in their 30s.
That's right. Yeah.
I even this Panthers team, which is a pretty mature, you know, you've got both Barkov and Matthew Tkachuk, like their highest paid star players are on third contracts. But even this team, you've got, you're in the last year, or you're going to be next year anyway. You're in the last year of Sam Reinhart's bridge.
Yep.
You know, you're going to be, next year is going to be the last year of Sam Bennett's bridge.
Verhage, Ekblad, Montour.
Ekblad's still a second contract guy, right?
Right.
That contract was widely panned, and now 7.5 is, you know, excellent. I mean, he would have gotten $2.5 million more based off of being the Calder winner,
yep.
You know, 15 goals a game, first overall pick, right? Like, he literally would have been, if he was expiring today, if he'd had his first three seasons today, he'd be making nine. Like, he'd be making Cale Makar money
right.
on his second deal, and maybe beating it, frankly. So, yeah, I mean, I don't think so. I think you genuinely need to have at least a mix of younger guys and a few guys that are still on their way up. And it's not about age as much as it's about contract status and what happens to really good players as they hit their 30s. They're, you know, at maximum, they're at their maximum price point.
Yeah.
And you know, I think you can have three or four of those guys, maybe if you're lucky, but I think at some point it becomes too much and just kind of weighs you down. You need some guys who are on their way up, some guys who are on bridges, some guys who are on ELCs. Like, you need the mix to make it all work.
I also just think the physical demands in the postseason, especially as you get older, it's just totally so much easier to manage when you're in your prime. Not that it's going to prevent you from getting hurt or, you know, just being overwhelmed, but I think it gives you a chance. Like, you watch this Panthers team and it's like, I don't know, just being a 32-year-old and having to deal with, like, this forecheck the entire time and the pace they play at and never getting a shift off must suck. As opposed to if you're a 24-year-old and you're like, all right, like, let's go. I can do this all night. And so I think it's really tough once you get into, especially, like, you can get away with it with certain parts or even key players, but I think if, like, that becomes your overarching identity or kind of just, like, the commonality on your team, then it becomes, like, kind of impossible.
Well, and, like, third-line center, right? Yeah. Third-line centers are so expensive. No one has good ones, right? And then you think about this being Lundell's last year.
Yeah.
Right? And just, like, what a massive edge. You know, Dallas made the Final Four in similar circumstances.
Yep.
You know, even the Oilers have McLeod, who's $2.1 million on a bridge, right? So, I mean, that's, for me, where just an example of, like, if your core consists of three $7 million centermen,
yep,
that to me feels like it's a very challenging way to have the depth you need to win late in the year.
All right, man. Well, I think that's all for today. This was a fun one. I'm glad we got to do one more show here before the games start. Anything you want to plug?
Just the usual. Just Canucks the usual? Talk, yeah. The Athletic. I'm around.
Just listen to me on the PDO cast. I'll be coming back for more appearances. All right, man. Well, this is a blast. As I said before, get into the Discord to join us and get in questions, maybe throughout the week we'll have time for more mailbags, especially on days in between games. But we will also be having shows night of games, so stick to the feed for that. And that's all gonna be all for today. So have a great weekend. Enjoy the games as they start on Saturday, and we'll see you back here Saturday night with more of the Hockey PDO cast streaming on the Sportsnet Radio Network.